friends and allies to another Red Ice radio program where we investigate and question what we've been told about history, our past, and of course how this reflects our current times and where it will take us in the future unless we have the correct story. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. We are a beacon of sanity in a world completely turned upside down, run by mythmakers and phonies in order to control our reality and subjugate human nature to their control system and their order. We expose this agenda of chaos and disorder by design. RedIceCreations.com is our website, run and dedicated to all humans who want to be free and live their lives as they want, under truth and honor, without manipulators and psychotic self-proclaimed leaders and saviors that we don't need. Today we're talking with David Matheson. He was a literalist for almost 20 years, reading the Old and New Testament scriptures carefully and literally. However, Matheson says that these texts remain some of the most exquisite crystallizations of esoteric teachings preserved from ancient times. Over the course of several years and in conjunction with a lifelong love of the stars and constellations, literature and mythology, and the examination of the writings of many authors and teachers and philosophers who have treated this subject, he began to finally see the outline of a vast system that underlies the ancient scriptures preserved in the Bible, in other scriptures which were rejected from inclusion in the Bible by the literalist, and in other systems of ancient wisdom which were once from around the globe. We are going to talk about his new book, The Undying Stars, and about the conundrum that if the New and Old Testament is a preservation of old esoteric teachings that already was found in a majority of so-called pagan traditions around the world, why was this new system so forcefully and brutally enforced on other people? We are going to talk about the dawn of the literalists and the expansion of monotheism, how this was created after the Roman conquest of Judea, and the people involved in the process and what their intentions and their motivations were. And welcome, David. Great to have you back again on the program. It was a few years ago, but it's nice to have you on again. So thank you for coming on.
Thanks, Henrik. I'm really, really happy to be here. And I can't say enough good things about everything that you and the team are doing there at Red Ice and all the contributors to the show, all your guests. We're really, I think for the most part, we're all on the same team. We're all trying to explore this issue together.
Well, indeed. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate that. And you've written a new book since we talked last time, The Undying Stars. Or I guess it's your first book, right? You didn't write a book before. We talked about the hydroplate theory and a number of other interesting things you were last with us. But this is your first one, right?
No, actually, I did. That's okay. That was The Matheson Corollary was the title of that book. And you can still find it up on Amazon. This is my second one. And they both had to do with challenging kind of conventional narratives, although I would say that The Undying Stars goes a lot further in challenging conventional narratives. That one had to do with the geological narrative, and I think it was in 2011 that I was on. So a lot has happened since then, and actually I've had to challenge some of the narratives that that I had bought into in between these two books. So I think, readers might see some, some different lenses being applied in this book than from the last one.
Well, that's interesting. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that? What has changed and what led you to those conclusions that you were needed to go in a new direction, if that's what happened?
Sure. So the Matheson Corollary was very much, coming from a literalist interpretation of the ancient scriptures, specifically the Old Testament and New Testament, although flood scriptures are found around the world. Most of your listeners are probably familiar, just about every single mythology in the world has a flood myth. But the Matheson Corollary is looking at a specific geological theory to which I still subscribe that says there is just tons of evidence that there was a worldwide flood, that the geology of the earth was shaped by a worldwide flood. But it was really from a literalist interpretation. And in that book, I do delve into the astrological or astronomical connections I originally originally when I wrote that book, I had thought that maybe this flood had been the cause of the tilt, you know, the Earth's obliquity,
right.
And that had gotten everybody interested in, you know, paying a lot more attention to the stars. Oh, wait a minute, you know, the North Pole's not where it was before, and you know, now we've got this procession of the equinoxes going on. So I, in that book, I really went into that a lot, and I touch on Hamlet's Mill, and it's quite clear that there is this celestial system, and I saw that in that book, but I really had been hesitating from applying that to the scriptures of the Old and New Testament. But some of the things that Hamlet's Mill talks about are, and I talk about them right up front in The Undying Stars, and in the first three chapters are online. If you go to my blog, I've got the first three chapters online, and they talk about this. And these were really the stories in the Old Testament that Hamlet's Mill addressed that have pretty clear celestial connections, specifically the story of Samson in Judges, when he goes down to meet with this particular maiden or young woman that he's enamored with. And on the way, he encounters this lion. And then he kills the lion with his bare hands. Then he meets up with the woman. Then as next time he's going through the area where he killed the lion, he sees the carcass. And lo and behold, there's a beehive. You know, these swarm of bees have made a hive in the carcass. And he pulls out honey. And Hamlet's Mill is a really interesting book. Your listeners, most of them, are probably familiar with it. I talk about it a lot in my blog. It was published in 1969. And they keep hinting at all the celestial connections, and they show some of the celestial connections, but a lot of times they'll say, now this clearly has a celestial connection, and then they'll kind of back away. It's almost like they're showing something, and then they drop the veil back on it again. So you have to read that book a lot of times. But
a lot of people have gotten into that kind of work because of that book as well. I think even John Anthony West got into it because of that book, and a number of other folks we talked with as well, actually.
Yeah, and you know, it's mentioned in, and Graham Hancock has mentioned it a lot. And
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So anyway, so the story of Samson going down to a maiden, or you know, beautiful woman, and then encountering a lion on the way, clearly has some zodiac connections, because the sign of the Virgin is, if you arrange the zodiac wheel, in a wheel of the cycle of the whole year, you've got, and you arrange the summit of the year as the summer solstice, okay? Because we know, you know, if you're watching the arc of the sun across the sky, it rises in the east, and it rises further and further north, if you're in the northern hemisphere, as you go towards the peak of summer. Because of that obliquity, the earth is pointed towards the sun. The North Pole is coming around to the solstice, where it's pointed most directly at the sun. So the sun is going to rise further and further north, further and further towards the North Pole as you get towards that summer solstice. And that's like they allegorize that as going up this high hill, this heavenly city on a hill, this city whose streets are paved with gold, right? The sun. So that is the peak of the year, when the sun reaches the summer solstice, and then it starts to arc across the sky lower and lower for those in the northern hemisphere, further and further towards the equator, which is further and further towards the south if you're in the northern hemisphere.
Yep.
And as it does that, it starts to rise further and further south along the eastern horizon and set further and further south along the western horizon. And as you're you know, heading down, then you cross the equinox crossing, where after the equinox, then the days are now going to be shorter than the nights. As you go down towards the very lowest point of the year, the winter solstice. Well, it turns out that for the zodiac wheel in the age of Aries, that summer solstice point is right between Gemini and Cancer, the two zodiac signs of Gemini and Cancer. And then from Cancer, as you arc downwards towards that equinox point, you're going to come across Leo and then Virgo. So right there, you've got a story in Samson where he's going down to meet with a beautiful woman, that's Virgo, and on the way he encounters a lion. And then he kills it with his bare hands, just like Hercules does. Then when he's coming back the next time, he finds a beehive in the carcass. And Hamlet's Mill, they don't, I don't think they tie all the dots together for you. They kind of leave it up to you. But in The Sign of Cancer, the crab, which is a very faint constellation, it's much easier to see Leo. In fact, Leo is pretty prominent right now in the hours after dark and before midnight. But in the constellation of Cancer, there's this beautiful little cluster of stars, which is M44 when it was categorized by Charles Messier. And it's called the Beehive Cluster. And you can see it. And if you look with binos, it's, or binoculars, it's really beautiful. But you can see it with the naked eye. And it was called the Beehive in ancient times. And that's why sometimes you see in these ancient portrayals of a lion, there's a little bee coming out of its mouth. That's right. Because Leo is right next to Cancer. And in these ancient portrayals of the Queen of Heaven or the great goddess like Ishtar, she has the lion's gate in Babylonia, or Rhea, all these ancient goddesses, often they're sitting on a throne and there's a lion crouching right next to their throne, or they're being pulled by a chariot of lions, or they're riding on the back of a lion. That's because going across the sky, Leo is right in front of Virgo. So as you're looking up at the stars tonight, you can see Virgo, and to the east, you'll see Leo out in front of her, like a lion pulling the goddess, or in Samson's case, it's a beautiful maiden. So she shows up in various myths in this system, either as a beautiful maiden, sometimes she's a young, virgin, sometimes she's the goddess. But anyway, so Samson, as a story, clearly follows that pattern. He's going down, then he's coming back up. He encounters the beehive. There's other things in the story of Samson, the two pillars that he's crushed in between. Those are probably the pillars of the solstices, the sun along the eastern horizon. It rises further and further north, and then it kind of gets to the solstice, the standstill. That's like the northernmost boundary. That's kind of like a pillar, and then it goes all the way down to the south, and then there's another stopping point. So there's a lot of celestial imagery in Samson. There's also, he has this, episode where he ties the tails of all these foxes together and lights them on fire. That clearly celestial imagery. We could, I could go on and show you how that connects to a constellation that's right near Virgo. But as someone who was interpreting the Bible literally, that was kind of problematic. Well, okay, did Samson, was he a real person, or is he something to do with these constellations? Did he really meet a lion, or is that Leo? And it's possible that that's all just a coincidence, except for the fact that as you go throughout the Bible, everywhere you turn, there are celestial images. And in the next one that I really had to wrestle with was in the book of Revelation. And so I talk about this in the first three chapters also, where you've got in Revelation 9, the smoke coming up from the bottomless pit. And then you've got these centaur creatures who are also kind of like locusts, who also have scorpions' tails. And literal Bible interpreters today, even to this day, say, oh, this is talking about, the last days, and there's going to be helicopters. These things look like, Black Hawk helicopters or something. But actually, if the Bible is literal, then it's correct to ask those kinds of questions. But Hamlet's Mill, the authors deal with this one too, and they cite some German texts, and a lot of times they'll cite it in the original German, but there's some scholars before them that they cite that say, huh, this looks just like the Milky Way. The smoke coming up from the bottomless pit is like the Milky Way rising on the horizon. And in the winter, winter in the northern hemisphere, you've got the beautiful constellation of Scorpio, who right now he's really prominent coming up out of the east right after the sun sets. Scorpio is a beautiful constellation. And in between the tail of Scorpio and Sagittarius, who, and I talk about this in blog posts going back, I've been writing blog posts since the last time, since the first book.
Yeah, you have a lot on the website or the blog. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So and Sagittarius really looks like a locust. I mean, it's a centaur. It's a centaur with the body, torso of a human, and often he's an archer. But he's got the body of a horse. He's being stung by the tail of the scorpion, and the Milky Way rises right up in between those two constellations. So clearly, Revelations 9 has very clear connections to that part of the sky that's just rising right now in the east. You have to, you know, you wait till midnight or 2 a.m. and you can really see it this time of year. But there's also the southern crown is right below the constellation Sagittarius. So in that passage in Revelation 9, they talk about these, you know, these centaur creatures kind of having crowns and really long hair. And, you know, what is that talking about? It's very clear. They put enough celestial clues in there for you to determine, well, this is that part of the sky that's being talked about in Revelation for some reason, as if it were literal. It's talking about it as, you know, I saw this happening, and this, you know, this, the angel opens this seal, and then this happened on the earth, and there was all kinds of wailing and terror and, you know, these scorpion creatures. But it's not literal. It's not intended to be taken literally. Mm-hmm. And the further and further you go through the Old Testament scriptures and New Testament scriptures, the more of these types of patterns you see. So really the first part of my book is talking about that system of celestial metaphor as it applies across. You know, some of my more recent blog posts have shown how this applies to the Norse myths, the myths of the Native Americans, myths even in Japan with the constellation Virgo and the other constellations that are around her show up in Japan very clearly. And but I really delve into the Old Testament and New Testament because I think it's really important to see that they all share the same system. There's been this historical narrative that's been put in place for the past 17 centuries that the scriptures of the Old and New Testament are very different. They're of a totally different character. They're meant to be taken literally. They're literal history. They're not connected to the pagan myths. The pagans were taking all these things literally and, you know, worshiping to Jupiter, and they didn't realize, I think the pagan myths, so-called, right. You know, the ancient sacred traditions of all the different, the Greeks didn't, I think they knew, they understood their myths esoterically as well. I think the Norse myths are meant to be understood esoterically because they all follow this same esoteric system. And we can get into a little bit of what, you know, as we go on, but since you asked, that's kind of the backstory. Right. In between these two books, I had to really wrestle with that because I got further and further into it, and I realized there's just no way that the Old Testament and New Testament are intended to be taken literally.
Literally, yeah, exactly. Well, you have a lot of that going on as well. There's so many things here, of course, so many details we're going to get closer into, but one of the things that's always been puzzling me is how much, you know, similarity there are between the different myths of all the different traditions out there, and yet there has been such a tremendous effort to eradicate the old system and bring in the new. But then at the same time, you come to realization that, wait a minute, there are so many different correlations in the system. And so what's the reasoning behind that? What has these battles been about? Because all the waves of, you know, civilization and conquest and all the different kings that unified, you know, Europe and crushed the native traditions, the indigenous people's traditions in Europe, etc. I mean, they were the first one who kind of got this wave, really, as it was coming out from Rome and everything else. But why this antagonism between the different systems then, if they all are so, if they correlate so much?
Well, that's the really important question is, so what about these esoteric, you know, what, so I've used the word esoteric a few times, and I think really quickly I'd like to just try and define that. you know, before when we were talking, you mentioned John Anthony West, and he's talked about Schwaller de Lubitsch and his work.
Yeah.
And Schwaller de Lubitsch has a book called Esotericism and Symbol. He's got a few other books also that talk about this concept of the esoteric. And one thing he says in there, you know, if you ask somebody what does esoteric mean, and I'm going to get around to answering your you know, that's the super important question.
Sure.
Why was my culture destroyed? Okay, well, let me get into the esoteric first.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
I think it'll help answer that question just really quickly.
Right.
One thing that Schwaller de Lubitsch says that really struck me was, so the typical answer is esoteric means really arcane, really known only by a few people, really hidden, maybe, you know, really kind of remote, you know, not too many people would even care about it. Maybe that's what esoteric, that's kind of the way it's used.
Yeah.
Or a hidden, it's like, we're trying to keep some secrets from you. But Schwaller de Lubitsch said something really interesting where he said, you know, it wasn't in order to hide information. It was in order to convey information that is very hard for the intellectual side of the brain to accept. The left side of the brain kind of chokes on this kind of profound information. And I think one of the best metaphors or examples really of esoteric in popular culture is the original Karate Kid, where where Ralph Macchio is Daniel, you know, Danny. He comes to the new town in LA and he's getting beaten up. And then this old guy, Mr. Miyagi, makes him, you know, says, hey, I'll teach you karate. You got to do everything I say. And he makes him start waxing the car. Then he makes him start sanding, you know, sanding his house and paint the fence. And after a while, Danny gets fed up and he goes, he says, hey, this is bullshit, man. What are you doing?
Yeah.
I'm just being your slave. I thought I was going to learn karate. And Mr. Miyagi says, Daniel-san. And all of a sudden he says, show me wax on, wax off. And Daniel-san kind of does it wrong, you know, half, he's got some attitude and he says, no, let me show it to me the right way. Do it just like this, wax on. And then, you know, and you get chills watching it the first time. It's a really powerful scene because all of a sudden, Mr. Miyagi launches this, you know, terrifying punch with a yell. He's right in his face and Daniel-san blocks it with wax on or wax off. And all of a sudden he starts to realize everything he's been doing is to teach him this ancient martial art and that Mr. Miyagi really cares about him, really cares about teaching it right. But he showed it to him. Why did he show him this way? Martial arts are always taught. That's esoteric. The wax on of the car, waxing the car, that's the literal, or that's the method. How come he didn't just say, look, when someone throws a punch at you, block it this way? Because Danny would be like, well, will that really work? I don't. Well, what if he does this? Well, what if he's got a knife? His left brain is going to get all in the way. He's going to choke on this information. Instead, he just makes him do it. Then he throws the punch at him, and all of a sudden, Danny knows. That's Gnosticism. That's Gnosis. He experiences it for himself. It goes right past his left brain. His left brain wasn't probably, he was probably daydreaming while he was waxing the car. His left brain wasn't engaged at all. His body was, you know, absorbing it into his emotion, what Schwaller de Lubitsch calls his emotional intelligence, and he knows Kung Fu. So you asked, or in that case, it's karate, but all the Kung Fu systems use an esoteric, they have these esoteric, very esoteric method. But the esoteric, was Mr. Miyagi teaching him wax on, wax off in order to hide something from him, in order to trick him? No, he wanted to teach him. He knew this kid needed his help, but he said, this is the way I learned it. This is the way it's taught. This is the right way to convey these things to a human brain in a human body. It's, you know, a complicated thing, a human brain in a human body. And this is the way it's taught. So the esoteric is a method of conveying. It's not a method of hiding. It's a method of teaching. But, you know, that karate can be used for protecting people, or it can be used for picking fights. That's what, you know,
sure, yeah.
Danny's problem was, all his all the other guys at school were going to this bad karate teacher who was teaching them how to use it for bad stuff and picking on kids. And he was picking on Danny, and he tried to fight him, and there was nothing he could do. He tried to fight these guys. There was nothing he could do. So, okay. So why would somebody destroy the esoteric meaning? Why would somebody say, in effect, hey, you know, all that wax on, wax off stuff, it is only about waxing cars. It is not about karate. And anybody who says it's about karate, you know, they're going to be exiled from this church. And why? Because they want to keep the karate system to themselves and keep that ancient wisdom for themselves and keep it from everybody else. That's the storyline that I talk about in this book.
Right. So just to clarify that, then the esoteric meaning contained within everything was something that was possessive in the quote pagan unquote system, right? The pre-Christian system. And then you had a different methodology coming in. And what explain us a little bit more of what the purpose of that was, what the function of that was.
Right. Okay, great. So what was the karate, you know, what was the kung fu of the ancient system? So this ancient wisdom permeates all the sacred traditions of the world. And in fact, you know, a lot of people who point out the astrotheology in the Bible, you have to be careful not to denigrate the Bible and say, oh, you know, to make fun of it, say, oh, look at this Moses character. Anybody who could literally believe in this guy who's going to go up and sacrifice his own son? This is rubbish. It's not rubbish. It's just like all the other pagan systems. It's teaching kung fu. It's teaching, and what is it? It's teaching a very sophisticated cosmology of how the universe works and what the human existence is all about. And who we are and why we're down here on this earth. It's just not what it's been twisted to teach by the literal interpretation. So all these ancient myths, whether it's the Norse myths, are teaching something about the universe that it is what I call holographic and shamanic.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's easier to say shamanic holographic, so that's how I usually word it in my blog posts and in the book. But holographic first, and this is the concept of the macrocosm and the microcosm, that every single individual walking around, you know, we've got this infinite heavens over our heads, these stars that when you stare up into the sky, you're basically staring out into infinity. It goes on and on as far as you can see, you know, and then some. That's also contained. We all carry around a little microcosm within ourselves. So the symbology or the esoteric metaphors in the Bible are not just celestial; they're also related to the human body. You know, you've had Santos Bonacci on, I think, maybe a couple of times.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
and you know, his work was really seminal in my book. He's one of the people to whom this book is dedicated, right up front there. Yeah. But he talks about, you know, the zodiac, and you can go back and I cite some of the ancient. There's ancient astrologers from the time of the Roman Empire prior to the takeover by the literalists, which we can talk about that timeline a little bit later, but that say, oh, you know, Aries is related to the top of the head and Taurus is related to the, you know, the neck and the mouth. And so you've got a zodiac in your body. And you've got a dome of heaven right there at the top of your body underneath that dome. That's where it all happens. That's where the whole universe really takes place for you. Because when you're staring out into the inky blackness of the night, your brain has to get those signals through a body, through the eyes, through, you know, turn into these electrical impulses. All that vision actually happens inside this sealed chamber of your head.
That's right.
Which has this brain in there. Yep. That's experiencing it. Okay. So what are they trying to tell us with that? They're trying to tell us that I'll cut through a whole lot of stepping stones, but what they're talking about is that the smallest piece of this universe contains a pattern of the whole thing, and modern quantum physics really got its start in the early 20th century, and it's really bizarre, and it really kind of like Daniel San, you know, if you start telling somebody the findings of quantum physics, they'll probably say, "What? Wait a minute, that can't be right." You know, my left brain just can't handle it. But as physicists started to wrestle with it, and Albert Einstein famously, you know, rejected it at first and said, "Oh, that's spooky." But as modern physicists have wrestled with the findings of quantum physics, they've come up with this model of the universe that one of the metaphors that they use is a hologram, where the information in the tiniest piece of holographic film, unlike regular film, if you cut a little, you know, if you cut a little piece of regular film out, you'll get a little hole in your picture. But if you take a little piece of holographic film where the hologram is stored, you'll actually still be able to project the entire hologram. The entire hologram is contained in each little piece. If you, you know, if you hit that little tiny piece of film with the same laser, it's got to be very concentrated laser light, which is why holograms weren't even really possible until the early 60s. But in the early 60s, as holograms started, you know, being made and becoming more and more available, some of these physicists who'd been wrestling with quantum physics said, "Hey, wait a minute, this is bizarre, but the hologram really seems to be a great metaphor for what we're finding in the universe, where the little piece contains the whole." In fact, it was this theoretical physicist who Carl Pribram, who was doing, he was removing different parts of the brains of rats to try and figure out where, you know, where are they storing the information of this maze,
yeah.
Which is kind of a hideous experiment,
yeah,
right? It's
yeah.
kind of inhuman experiment. We could, you know, PETA would say, "That's horrible. Why are you doing that?" But anyway, they were doing that, and they were finding that no matter how many different pieces they took out of the brain, the rat still knew the maze. And he said, "Where is this being stored?" It's like, and people who have had terrible brain injuries have been able to somehow function where the doctors say, "Wait a minute, that should be, that should have been lost, but it wasn't. I don't, you know, I'm not even sure where this stuff is being stored." So it's like the hologram. We're like a little tiny piece of the universe, but we contain the whole thing. Each person that you see walking around contains in their head a little universe. So it's a holographic vision of as above, so below, you know, the hermetic wisdom that, you know, a lot of your guests have talked about, a lot of your listeners are familiar with. I believe that's what that's why they were talking about these cycles of the heavenly bodies and the star, the motion of the stars, the motion of the planets, the motion of the sun and the moon. And it's shamanic in that, and this also modern, you know, theoretical physicists who have put forward models have said, you know, there's this, and David Bohm, B-O-H-M, is one who has really explored this. He says it's like there's an implicate order and an explicate order.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's talking about is the implicate order is like the seed world. You know, when you have a seed, it's like, where's the plant in that seed? Well, the seed is all potential. Right.
Yeah.
And even like a redwood tree comes from a really tiny, you know, pine cone. It's really small. You'll see one when you come to San Mateo, you know, big, tallest trees in the world.
Yeah.
Where is that redwood in that seed? Well, it's the implicate order is like the seed realm of information. It's like the holographic film where the information is stored and then it's projected outward into this explicate realm. And theoretical physicists have said, you know, we found evidence that the universe really works like that. Okay, so why would I say it's also shamanic? They're crossing over into that implicate realm, the seed realm. In ancient Egypt, they talk about going into the duat, or there's some researchers who say, you know, all these pyramids that have sarcophagi in them that no body was ever found in them, I don't think they were using those pyramids primarily for burial. They were using those for basically what we would call today shamanic journeys or out of the body journeys. They were lying down in there under the attendance of, you know, people who knew how to do this, and they were going on journeys. And then at the end of the ritual, it says, you know, they're saying, "Hey, come back, king, come back to your body. You're not dead. Come back." And as consciousness comes back, they were going out of the body. They were crossing over. And if you look you know, Norse mythology, for instance, where Odin hangs on the tree. It is going into this other realm where all of a sudden the literal things that he sees, the twigs on the ground, suddenly have a higher meaning to him. Oh, I see the runes down there. And he's getting in touch with, he's going across the boundaries. And a lot of times a shaman will turn into an eagle or a swan, have swan feathers. The tree, you know, the Milky Way has two very prominent birds in it, the eagle and the swan. The shamanic journeys, typically a shaman, and Mircea Eliade did the most massive, or really the definitive discussion of shamanic techniques around the world, where he was really talking to people who had still were part of this tradition. A lot of times they'll talk about ascending up into this hole or into this black tunnel. And it's the same thing that people describe in near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. They're going into that implicate realm. And these ancient scriptures, whether they're Norse or, you know, ancient sacred traditions, they don't necessarily have to be written down as scriptures, the shamanic cultures of the world, the same pattern over and over. It's not just celestial, it's also the human body. And it's not just human body and celestial, it's also has to do with these two realms that interpenetrate each other. And it also has to do with the techniques of crossing over those boundaries.
Right.
And if you look in the New Testament, Paul, and there's been some, you know, really good studies, and I mentioned some of the authors in my book that say, you know, Paul was really a Gnostic. He was not a literalist at all. His stuff was later twisted into literalism. Paul talks about going out of the body. He says it quite clearly. I was out of the body. I didn't know whether I was in the body or out of the body. You know, I went up into the third heaven. I don't even know if I should tell you some of the things I saw. It's shamanic.
Right.
It's shamanic. That's so, okay. So the question, original question, I went down a long road was, well, why would someone want to stamp this out? Because maybe that stuff actually works. I mean, maybe, you know, we have these peoples in the Amazon who know about medicines that, you know, modern science would say, well, how did they actually figure that out? Because trial and error, first of all, you've got just so many different things in the Amazon, but trial and error is going to, you know, just kill off a whole lot of people. Jeremy Narby has talked about this. There's some evidence that this advanced knowledge, well, in the people themselves, the shamans themselves will say, well, the plants told us, or, you know, we learn these things by going into this other realm. So there's access to technologies, there's access to techniques, there's access to knowledge that the ancient people had that somebody didn't want everybody to have anymore. Maybe everybody never had it. Maybe it was always, hey, this stuff could be used. It's like karate. You know, somebody could abuse this. Maybe we got a situation where this has always been somewhat restricted, but I think it's pretty clear in the Roman times you had the mystery traditions were going on. Those were open to everybody. And the contemporary writers like Plutarch and others have said, you know, people who have gone through this, they see the other side. They no longer have a fear of death. It changes their life. Those techniques were actively stamped out by the literalists in a historical event. And ever since then, the shamanic peoples of the world have been being oppressed and their ancient wisdom stamped out and co-opted or stolen by the people who don't want this information to be. It's like humanity's birthright is being attacked.
Right.
And I would say just, you know, the very last tail end of this is there's also some evidence that the ancient wisdom that is contained in all these sacred traditions around the world came from some lost civilization or some lost people even before the historical civilizations of Egypt and Babylon and Sumer, and, you know, as far back as you want to go, even, you know, Göbekli Tepe, there was probably a very advanced technology. When you see some of these gigantic stones that are just cut like as if they were butter and moved around and with precision, and these cyclopean megalithic sites that are, by the way, in and of themselves, they suggest incredible technology, but they're also located on this planet, specific distances from one another, on great circles, which a great circle is a circle that's the size of the circumference of the Earth. So when you've got all these different sites lined up on a great circle, and Giza, which is a very old, you know, the Great Pyramids, is on that same great circle, and it shares that same great circle with places in, you know, the Pacific Ocean and in the Americas, so the sites in and of themselves suggest a very high technology, but the interrelationship of all these sites suggests a very high technology, an understanding of this planet and its energies potentially that is very sophisticated. And the remnants of that knowledge, I think, are found in the ancient scriptures and traditions around the world. And that was the legacy of whoever, you know, went before, whoever those people were. And that legacy was functioning and still functions in places that have, you know, there's still a few shamanic cultures where the Roman Empire didn't get to and stamp it out. But in general, you know, I think the reason they want to stamp it out is because these technologies or techniques actually can give knowledge, actually can give control. Actually, it's like karate. It can be used the wrong way. And it was supposed to be everybody had access to it, and it was for good and for healing. If you look at shamanic cultures, the shaman is someone who heals people. Or when the people, you know, when there's no game, he figures out, okay, well, you know, what's the problem? I got to go to the spirit world and find out why all the animals are avoiding us right now. He's there to help and build up and do positive things. But, you know, there's run-ins with evil shamans and things like that. But in general, these techniques are for the good of humanity, and I think they've been stolen and co-opted and hoarded by, you know, people who didn't want anybody else to know their kung fu moves, so that they could basically, you know, rule the town because nobody else knows kung fu anymore.
Right. It's for purposes of control. That's really what this boils down to. I wanted to ask a little bit more about the takeover by the literalists then, because it's interesting how then we have a kind of a removal from the story tale version, from the saga, basically, towards the literal. And so what we've had is, seems to me anyway, is that we're basically a system which is very much carrying the essence of the old system, but this new one is coming in by tremendous force. It's basically, you know, if you stand in our way, if you don't convert, in some cases, we'll kill you in front of your family. We'll burn the knowledge that you have. We'll force you to convert. To bring something in then by force that kind of already was there in place. So there's a swap along the way here somewhere, where they move from saying, I mean, because look at some of the Slavic mythologies, for example, of there's tremendous correlation between the later saints that they worshipped in the Orthodox Christian Church with actually pre-Slavic, you know, pagan gods. And so you realize that, okay, they just basically said here, well, you know, we put a new kind of a name on it, a new face, but it's really the same deity, so you can go ahead as usual, right? And it was like that for a while. You had this dual, you know, double worship of the old system and the new system. But something to me happens along the way as well. I'm not saying that the enforcement of it wasn't easy and that it wasn't violent, because it was, but at the same time, it was a leniency. But then after a certain point, it's a move towards the literalist, if you will. What happened there? How do we explain that?
Right. So that, yeah, you've really you've laid out a lot of stuff right there. You've touched on a lot of really important points, and so I would agree with you that there was violence, but I would say that also the stamping out or the suppression of the literalism was also done by techniques of not necessarily overt violence all the time. So sometimes there was that the kind of the slaughter in front of, you know, the family that you talk about when, you know, like Charlemagne conquering, you know, and subduing these, the Germanic, you know, it's very clear that those kinds of slaughters were going on. But going back to, so I divide the book into three sections. The first part is about this celestial system. You know, what is it? How does it work? The second part is, what does it mean? Which we touched on a little bit with the shamanic holographic. And the third part is, well, what happened to it? And so I believe that the turning point in history may be the fall of the temple in Jerusalem in AD 70. And because at that point, people who knew this system, knew it inside and out, and had run a religious system of control and hierarchy for centuries and knew the system, were wedded up with the military power of the Roman Empire. And that was the vehicle that they used. Once they got control of it, it's like, you know, if the Roman Empire was a giant killing robot, they got control of that thing and they were able to steer it wherever they wanted to.
Right.
So how did they get control of the Roman Empire? Okay.
And by the way, sorry to interrupt, I keep that thought, sure. But I just want to mention that's a good analogy as well, because usually, I mean, it's all about controlling the mind and the hearts of those who wield the power as well, right? We talk about the kingmaker, those behind the throne. People can look at, of course, who is wielding the sword, etc. But if they are ideologically driven by someone who's, you know, manipulated them or taken over their control, it's a completely different animal that we're dealing with. So that's a really good point that you mentioned, that it's about taking control of that robot, as you will. But please pick up where you left off.
Yeah, that's right. And okay, so and this is where I bring in a theory from a researcher named Flavio Barbiero. And I don't know if you've ever had him on your show, Henrik, but
no, we've not.
Yeah, his research is quite extensive, and he backs up his thesis with a lot of evidence. And I would say, you know, I don't want to speak for him, but he has, you know, some aspects of literalism in when he's talking about the Old Testament figures of Moses. Okay, he treats Moses as a literal person. He has a book called The Secret Society of Moses, but you know, so. Hey, we're all exploring these things with our different perspectives and our different life histories and our different strengths and our different backgrounds. So I'm not trying to, you know, put his theory down in any way.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, it's very central to what I'm talking about. So when he's exploring what happened at AD 70, the conquest of Judea by the Romans, specifically by Titus and his father, Vespasian, coming into the Roman Empire and conquering basically the temple and taking taking the treasures from the temple. You can see it on the Arch of Titus. You know, they had a joint triumphal procession in Rome, both the father and the son, Titus and his father. The Flavians. This was the start of the Flavian dynasty. They sacked the temple, and it's spoken of in the scriptures of the New Testament. You know, Jesus says, "Not one stone will be left upon another," and you know, this whole temple will be torn down someday. Okay, what Barbiero's theory is that there was a member of the priestly line. The people of Judea fought very ferociously against the Roman emperor. He wasn't the emperor, the general who was coming in. And the first battles to take place were up in the region of Galilee. And there was a young priest from a priestly line, from a very distinguished family, who was leading that resistance. And he was besieged by eventually he was driven back into the kind of the fortress there and besieged by the Roman armies and kind of like, in Helm's Deep, where they, retreat back there in the Lord of the Rings. It was that kind of situation in the fortress of Jotapata or Yotapata. And eventually the last defender said, you know what, I don't think we're going to, I think we're toast here. Let's all draw straws and kill each other so that we're not captured. Mm. And they all kill each other until the last two are staring, the last two are supposed to run each other through simultaneously, and they're staring at each other and they say, you know what? Let's see if we can talk with these Romans.
Great and, strategy, at that point.
And it turns out one of them was the priest from the priestly lines, and he goes out and he talks to the Roman general, and he says, my God has revealed to me that you guys are basically the force in charge, secular power in this world today. You guys have the military might. It would be useless for me to just throw my life away. And also he's revealed to me that you're going to become the emperor. And at that point, the general says, wow, I'm going to become the emperor? Your God told you this? I'm going to shower you with honors and give you a villa. In fact, I'm going to give you a place in my own house, and you're going to have your pick. I'm going to take you back to Rome and make you a star.
My God.
Does that sound a little bit strange?
Very strange, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the way that the story is presented by this particular individual in his histories, and he's very famous, and his name is Josephus. Okay. Yep. Josephus says this is what happened. He said, because I told the general that he was going to be the emperor, he showered me with all these gifts. And Flavio Barbiero says, that doesn't exactly ring true. here's this defeated guy, and he comes out and talks, and he asks for an audience with the general. The general grants it to him, which is kind of strange because Vespasian and Titus executed a whole lot of priests very ruthlessly. So why did he talk to this guy? And what Flavio Barbiero says is that Josephus knew how to get to the treasure of Jerusalem. And he promised that to Vespasian, because just like in any other political campaign, you've got to have money. And Vespasian really needed money at this point, and he wanted to be the emperor. And Josephus says, listen, if I give you access, I've got some treasure stored up, because he talks about it he wrote a lot of texts that are still around today. And he said, I was saving up money to build a new wall, but, that never happened because the Romans invaded. Well, he probably said, look, I've got some money here I can give you for now, but you just wait. When we get to Jerusalem, because Jerusalem hadn't fallen yet, the temple hadn't fallen, I can give you access to the big bank. And Vespasian said, okay, I haven't run you through yet. I'm still here. Keep talking. And that's what happened. So
the allure of the gold, huh? The treasure.
Well, yeah. So how did how did Titus get all that gold? How did we see it being led on the Arch of Titus? It's being led in the triumph. And Josephus says, look, in the triumph, there was all these slaves, there was all this treasure, there was all this booty that Vespasian and Titus had brought with them. But the crowning moment of the whole triumph that everybody in Rome, thought was the summit of the whole thing was when they brought in the treasure from the temple of Jerusalem. So how did they get that?
So this is Flavius Josephus mentioning this to Vespasian, correct?
Right. So He took the name Flavius. This was very common in the Roman Empire. When a slave was freed or granted his freedom, he would take the name of the emperor. So it was Titus Flavius. The Titus the emperor was the son of Titus Flavius Vespasian. So this was a father-son campaign. These two generals, they were sent to Judea. They got the money to keep paying their troops, and they eventually marched into Rome and became the emperors. This was after basically the Julian dynasty. You had a power struggle after the Julians were done. Julius Caesar and Nero and Claudius. And once that line was done, there was a big power struggle, and generals were marching into the city and then getting killed, or another general would take them out, and there was a power struggle, and eventually Vespasian became the emperor, and then his son Titus took over when Vespasian died. So Titus Flavius Josephus was given, he was brought back to Rome, and you know, his life was spared, and he was given, basically when the emperor, when Vespasian moved into it, built a new palace for himself, he gave Josephus his old villa, so where he had been living. So Barbiero says this is all circumstantial evidence that some kind of a deal took place beyond just, hey, I've gotten a message from my God that you're gonna win and that you're gonna be the emperor. Because as Flavio Barbiero points out in his book, there had been prophecies that Vespasian was going to be the emperor given to him before by, you know, different oracles. In fact, even when he was born, supposedly an oracle said that he was going to be the emperor. So what's one more, you know, is one more prophecy really deserve all this lavish reward that Josephus was given? And so Josephus, in his publications, was covering this up. He's a little bit hazy when he's talking about these points. He's putting out a story. He's using history to cover his tracks. And so, but the point I was also steering towards, one other point, was how did those Romans actually get a hold of the treasure? Because it was a long, bitter siege of Jerusalem after Josephus surrendered. It was about 3 years before Josephus surrendered in, I think, AD 67. The temple didn't fall till AD 70. And the defenders, the zealot defenders, you know, they were very zealous and very ferocious fighters. They were warriors too. The Romans respected them. They burned down the temple as much as they could so that it didn't fall into the Romans' hands. They were like, you're not getting any of this. So how did Titus actually get all that treasure? How did he?
Yeah.
Well, that's, Flavio Barbiero talks about this, and he says, you know, there was this interesting discovery called the Dead Sea Scrolls after World War II in the region of Galilee, where they found these scrolls buried in a cave, and most of the scrolls were ancient scriptures, like the scroll of Isaiah, but one of them was this copper scroll. It was on copper, unlike all the other ones. And it was so old that it wouldn't even unroll. They had to take it back to England and they cut it into strips. And when you read the copper scroll, it's really strange. It's not like any of the other ones. It's not a scripture. It just goes like this. Line one, at Horeba, which is in the Vale of Achor, under the stairs which go eastwards 40 cubits, a box silver weighing in all 17 talents. Line two, in the tomb of somebody, 100 gold bars. Number three, in the great cistern, which is in the courtyard. So what's going on here? And so John M. Allegro was actually one of the Qumranists who was translating the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he said, I think this is a treasure list.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Mm. And he was opposed by all the other mostly religious scholars who were on the team. He was kind of iconoclastic, but he said, I think this is a treasure list. I'm going to spend my life looking for this stuff. And he never found any of it. He tried to figure out what all these references were to. And whenever he got there, it was empty, or, you know, he didn't find anything. Obviously it's been 1700 years, but why didn't he find anything? Because the last line on the copper scroll says, in the underground cavity, which is in the smooth rock north of Colet, whose opening is towards the north with tombs at its mouth, there is a copy of this writing and its explanation and the measurements and the details of each item. So the copper scroll in the Dead Sea Scrolls was the backup copy. The reason they put it on copper was so it wouldn't, you know,
remain.
This was a lot of treasure. They didn't want to lose it. It could last through fire. It could last through water if it was printed on copper, unlike all the other scrolls. But this was a copy. There was another one, and Josephus probably knew where that was. He makes it very clear in his writings that he was a big member of the premier family of Judea before the Romans took it over.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a military commander. And so he probably said, listen, what we're going to do is we're going to get that scroll, and then we'll send out little I'll lead little groups of soldiers, little, you know, give me a platoon and I'll take them at night and we'll go to one after the other and we'll get all that treasure when nobody's looking. Because the way he describes it in his histories of the Jewish wars, he calls it, two priests, you know, treacherous priests lowered the treasure down over the walls to the Romans. Okay. And Flavio Barbiero says that really makes no sense. By the time that the Romans, by the time the priests finally gave up, they burned down the temple. And secondly, if the other defenders saw two priests lowering all this treasure, and it's a lot of treasure, over the walls, they would have killed them. They would have said, what are you doing? Why are you giving the Romans this stuff?
Right.
That's not how it happened. So, okay, so how did this, so we're getting all the way back to your question of how did literalism take over?
Yeah.
So Josephus, he says it in his writings, he was able to save several, you know, the Titus and Vespasian, the two generals, the father and son, put to death a lot of the defenders, but Josephus was allowed to go pick the people that he wanted to save and the families that he wanted to save. And they all went to Rome, which you can understand why they went to Rome. They, staying in Judea was not an option for these guys because they would be seen as the traitors.
Well, exactly. Yeah, this is what I was, you know, we've talked about before as well, the deal struck here and the how the cooperation began. Because, I mean, this what you mentioned here on the Copper Scrolls is like the, you know, inventory list of the treasure coffers of the Goldman Sachs of the times, you know?
So. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so when Vespasian and then later Titus became the emperor, and Flavio Barbiero shows the, you know, cites a lot of evidence, they picked these former Jewish fighters to be their guard, their bodyguards, the Praetorian Guard. Why? Because, you know, this was a time when there was assassinations going on right and left for who's going to be the emperor. And so they didn't want to surround themselves with other people from Italy who might, you know, be these guys that they brought to Rome with them from Judea had an interest in keeping Vespasian and Titus alive because that was their ticket to, hey, they were the favorites of the emperor now. And so he put them in charge of protecting his life, and they had a mutual interest. And the Praetorian Guard is where, according to this theory, and Flavio Barbiero lays out just a extensive evidence, this is where the heads of the priestly families, including Josephus, said, you know, I think we can set up a religion here. We know how to do it. We're the experts in this.
Right.
We know this esoteric system inside and out. And they created something called Mithraism.
Right.
Mithras. That is, according to the Barbiero theory, that is basically a creation of these families. And it starts, the very first Mithraeum is in the vicinity of the barracks of the Praetorian Guard. And there's an inscription in the Mithraeum of a freedman, probably someone who came from Judea, who took the name of Flavius. And so it's pretty evident that they said, hey, let's start a secret religion here amongst us in the Praetorian Guard. And let's start getting control of, once we've secured the control of the Praetorian Guard, let's get control of the army. And let's get control of certain financial centers like the customs, where the government bureaucracy. And that's what they did. Through the vehicle of Mithraism, they used that as a kind of a secret society. It was only open to men. It was hierarchical. And according to the Barbiero theory, which he presents some evidence for this, to get to the higher grades where you really learn the secrets of the esoteric inside knowledge and got to talk about the plans to take over the Roman Empire, you had to be from one of these priestly families.
All right. Let me stop you right there. This is very interesting. I want to pick this up, and I have so many more questions about this, of course, but we'll continue the story here just in a little bit, David. Before we do that, though, obviously we have a lot of details we want to give out. I want to spend a few minutes on this as well, because you're going to be in San Mateo as well. You're going to show up there. You're going to be having a table there where you're going to have some books and stuff like that, signing some books and things like that. That's what I want to talk a little bit about. And then, of course, your website where people can get copies of the book if they are not going to be there. And if there's anything else additionally that you'd like to mention as well, so please go ahead and give us the details there.
Sure. Thanks, Henrik. It is, the book is called The Undying Stars, and it's on Amazon. And it's in paperback and hardback now. And it's also available on my, I have a blog that's been going for, I guess there's over 3 years of content on there now, called The Matheson Corollary. And you can just search for that and you'll find it pretty easily. Matheson is spelled M-A-T-H-I-S-E-N, Matheson Corollary. Corollary is C-O-R-O-L-L-A-R-Y, just like a mathematical corollary. So, so the secret space program happens to be that the conference happens to be in San Mateo, California. That's the place I was born. That's the town I grew up in. That's that's where I went to high school. The fairgrounds there, you know, that's where I used to wait for the train.
Anyway, cool.
Yeah. So I said, wow, I've got to go to this. You know, Henrik's going to be there. Joseph Farrell is going to be there. And there is a, you know, this isn't my, you know, my book does not talk about the secret space program, but it talks about the ancient technologies. And Joseph, you know, Farrell has talked about there's ancient civilization, you know, there's evidence, and he's talked about the grid of these locations around the world shows that these people, these ancients, whoever they were, and I think they were, and I think he does too, were before history. So it ties in, and I think probably these families that we were just talking about, may tie into this story as well, as you know, maybe we'll explore that a little bit in the second hour. But so to answer your question, the best place to find the book is to go on Amazon, or I've got links on the website there. I will be signing copies, so I'll have some at the Secret Space Program conference. I'll have some hardback and some softback there. If you want to buy one on Amazon and bring it, I'd be happy to write, you know, an inscription in there for you, or answer questions about all this with you, or, you know, just talk about general matters of interest in the world. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm really excited that it happens to be here in California where I live. I don't live in San Mateo anymore. I've moved a couple hours down the coast, but still have a lot of family up there. I go back up there a lot, and really looking forward to the conference.
Me too. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, and it's great that you'll be there as well. Let me mention again here the book, The Undying Stars, and the website is Matheson Corollary, and it's .blogspot.com, and we're going to have the links up to that as well. And of course, if you want to check out the conference that we've been talking about quite a bit with some of the speakers, upcoming speakers, they'll be at the event as well. Check out secretspaceprogram.org for tickets and everything else. And again, I've reiterated this many times, but in case you're listening to this and haven't listened to previous shows, in our member section on redicemembers.com, if you remember, grab the discount code there as well for the tickets to the conference. So that's a valuable little something off from the regular ticket price. All right, we have much more to discuss. David, stay with us here. We're looking forward to picking up in the second hour, second segment. So we'll be right back, everybody. We'll see you soon. Thank you.